Program. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. How's everybody doing this evening?
Doing great, Sam.
Doing well. Well, we've been on assignment for the last week and a half, so to our listening audience, we want to just ask, first of all, say thank you for joining us, and want to ask you to reach out to your friends and family and tell them to tune in that Just Cause Coast to Coast is on live this evening. And we're going to be talking about something that one of the many subjects that's in the news a lot, and that is regarding the death penalty. And so we're going to be talking about the wrongfully convicted who are on death row. And joining us this evening in a little while is going to be Victoria Redstall. And she is an investigative reporter, freelance investigative reporter that looks into these types of cases. And so she's going to have some interesting information to share with us. Lisa, why don't we jump to the disclaimer?
Okay, we want to just remind everyone that we are not attorneys and that a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. You want to contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. And as always, we want to thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend time with us this evening.
Our phone number, if you'd like to call in and participate in the program, is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. We'd love to hear from you. There are a lot of things that are in the news that we're going to jump to before we get to our main subject. And so, Lamont, I know you were talking about the situation out there in L.A. So let's talk about that just a little bit.
Yeah, apparently the Los Angeles Police Department shot and killed a homeless man. His name is very difficult, Sam. Maybe you can have it. Charlie Landau Caning.
Hey.
That's the best I could do with it.
That's about as good as I would do as well.
Homeless man was shot. Apparently, I believe there were, 7 to 9 officers out there, at least on the information that I had saw, has stated that the homeless man attempted to reach for a gun of one of the officers. It goes back to this question that I've had with all the killings regarding cops shooting innocent people to the taser effect. Where is the alternative route to slow down a suspect? That taser is used to slow down a charging suspect, someone who is being very, very much aggressive. Maybe coming towards in a threatening way towards a cop. That is what the taser is for. In the Michael Brown shooting, no taser was used. The statement was made that, he didn't feel like putting on the alternative gear that morning. This is utterly ridiculous.
Absolutely.
So if you have 7 to 9 guys, cops, trained cops, you're telling me not 9 guys cannot refrain one homeless man. He lays down and they shoot him. My understanding, I thought he got shot in the back because they said he was down on the ground when they shot him. So whatever excuses they want to give, I know they came and tried to put a spin on it that this man was wanted, had been in trouble with the law previously. There, you know, what really gets me about that is that they always attempt to smear the name of the person they've killed to give some type of justification why they've killed this man. I don't care if he was wanted or not. A man does not deserve to die. If a man is wanted, he's not guilty or convicted of any crime. So if a wanted man, it simply means there's a warrant for his arrest that's out there. Doesn't mean he's guilty of anything. So I just think it's tragic. If the cops got to go down the skid row to find suspects and you feel the need that you need to brutally shoot a man, a homeless man on skid row, that's where you get your satisfaction from. That is the sickest stuff I've ever heard in my life. You know what I mean? He was 43 years old. Yeah, you know, there was a time in this country where you didn't have to fatally shoot anybody to bring somebody down. I think that's the going culture, as we've talked before, Sam, in regards to the culture that is set across this country in police departments these days. And nobody's asking that question. Where's the taser? Where's the pepper spray? I can tell you right now, for being wrongfully convicted and falsely incarcerated, pepper spray will put you down very, very quickly. And I'm just trying to figure out, why is that not being done that way? That doesn't make any sense to me.
And Lamont, I'm looking at this same article, and they're talking about, excuse me, how the difficulties that the police face strolling Skid Row, because a lot of the people down there are mentally ill, they're on drugs, whatever the case may be. I think there has to be something said about these officers being overly violent and jumping the gun and just killing people without just exhausting every other possibility. It's ridiculous that everywhere you look, somebody's just getting shot to death. That should not be the only option. It's not the only option. It's just what they choose to do.
And that's the bottom line. I mean, you know, if a person does not adhere to protocol for a police officer in regards to wearing alternative sources of trying to stop a suspect. You know what I mean? You got rubber bullets you can use. You have so many different options. And how 7 to 9 officers could not get on each arm of this guy and hold him down. But now they take the holding them down. They smother them and suffocate them to death doing that.
They sure do.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, the police department needs to be looked at in regards to protocol and procedure. There's got to be training for that. That you just don't go out, this guy's wanted, let's go ahead and kill him. These are human lives.
Well, you know, Lamont, we just participated in a forum, an open forum this week in the city of Colorado Springs, where you had the chief of police and the sheriff and the district attorney there and so forth. And, you know, they actually spoke to that particular issue. Now, you know, obviously they can't speak to the nation on a whole, but they did speak to the issue of lethal force and using the option of less lethal force. And, you know, and they brought up the situation of the Michael Brown case as well, where, you know, they couldn't understand why Officer Wilson did not have his gear on. You know, that's like, you know, the gear, like you just said, the gear is issued for a purpose. And when you have that as an option, I mean, you have Michael Brown unarmed, and when you have an option that's available to you as far as less lethal enforcement, then you should use it. Now, you know, as far as you were talking about protocol and training, now we were enlightened on, and I might be, I think, you know, research team, help me out if I missed this, but I think they even stated that until last year, there was no mandatory requirement for continuing ed for patrol officers and people that are on the street. They had mandatory continuing ed for attack dogs or if you're attacked by an animal or something like that. But as far as for the officers themselves, until last year, they didn't even have mandatory continuing ed. Now they do have 24 hours a year. Now, you know, even the chief spoke to that, and he said, you know, that there's so many things that you can cover, and you think, well, 24 hours basically equates to 3 days. Can you really cover everything in 3 days? So, you know, he hinted to the fact that they should actually require more, but they are taking steps, at least in their municipality, to ensure that those things are adhered to. And the subject of body cameras came up. And so, you know, it's another one of those things. And you know, talked about it, you know, well, if an officer is wearing a body camera, should he have the option to turn it on and turn it off?
Well,
it defeats the purpose if he turns it off.
Well, I saw something on, I believe it was on Facebook, regarding an officer. I don't remember exactly the details, but I know the officer, there were 3 officers there, and they got ready to, from what I gathered, they got ready to assault this young man. One of the officers caught on camera saying, hold up, we got to turn the camera off. Took off back to the car to turn the camera off.
I remember seeing that.
So nothing would actually be seen. You know what? That he should have been fired and brought up on criminal charges.
Oh, that would be, you would think a situation like that would be an immediate reason for an indictment of a rogue cop. I mean,
sure.
One of the things that we talked about in that open forum was the fact that you have an appreciation for the law enforcement officers that are out there that are doing it right. But for those who choose to circumvent the system, they should be held accountable. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
And that's when legislation has to be filed in states. And I believe personally, legislation needs to be filed strictly with the police department and those in positions of authority, peace officers. There needs to be state legislation that holds these people accountable, that says, if you do not do this, laws can be written for that purpose. Given what has happened in this country with the abuse of power by police officers all across this country, and you know, and I know, Sam, we'll get to the Ferguson situation as well, but you're dealing with something has to be done, and people have to be held criminally. Criminally, they need to be held accountable. That if you don't follow protocol, this is about public safety. You are a person in a position of power and authority. If you don't adhere to this, if you don't put your gear on, that is supposed to be the taser, supposed to be the pepper spray, you can be brought up on charges for an intent to inflict harm on somebody that you shouldn't be able to do that to.
That's right.
Those are actions that have to be taken. It's not enough in the police department, because a lot of times the police department is doing the exact same thing. They are endorsing their officers. As we said a few weeks ago, Sam, this is a culture that is endorsed by officers all within the system. So the lieutenant's not going to say nothing. Then the captain's not going to do anything. Well, who's going to do what? It has to go to a higher level of accountability. That's where the answer starts. That's where the problem at least can start being hopefully fixed.
Absolutely.
And I just want to say real quick, one thing that's really starting to annoy me, every time we have these issues where someone's being shot to death, they always come out after the fact. Now, this man was shot on Sunday. Then they start coming out the next week talking about all these things that he did wrong, and he was using someone else's name. And they always come up with all these things about the person that they shot down.
Yep.
To explain their actions away, like, well, like they should have been shot down because of this. That's cool. Not the case. I'm tired of them always coming back with something. They want to just throw out all this negative information about this person that they killed, that they had no right to kill. That is beginning to get really, really old.
Well, that's to take the light of criticism or what's going on to them. That's to take it off of them and put it on some other issue. It's to defer the actual real problem, where you got everybody talking about what this man did, and you lose sight of the fact the cops shot this man dead in the street. Let's deal with that issue before you want to change the subject.
That's right.
And, you know, let's move on to the next item that you mentioned, Lamont, and that is the Ferguson situation. And, you know, one point, the situation that just occurred in Los Angeles, it just adds to the list. We have not even approached a year yet from the Michael Brown case. So you got Michael Brown, you got Eric Garner, you got Tamir Rice. Now you have the guy in L.A. And so the Department of Justice just completed their report of the situation in Ferguson. And it's atrocious. I mean, when you look at the way that city is run, and when you look at the chief of police there in Ferguson, Missouri, and the mayor, Congressman Clay, he's actually calling for their resignation. I saw him on CNN this afternoon, and he was saying, you know, whenever you implement a system of government that is basically oppressive to the poor, and deliberately oppressive to the poor, something needs to be done about that. So they implemented a process whereby fines and citations and everything were just dumped onto the back of the people who cannot afford it. And so, you know, here is one article from CNN.com, and it's talking about how Attorney General Eric Holder, he's saying that there is a systemic discrimination against African Americans in Ferguson. No kid. I mean, you know, I've had conversations, and Lamont, you and I last week in one of our meetings last week, we had that discussion with someone regarding folks always want to jump up and say, well, if people in Ferguson don't like the way the system is set up, then vote them out. Well, they can't vote them out, even though Ferguson has the majority population is African American. But if the system is set up where you're going to slap a felony on almost everybody there, and then there are rules in that city say that, well, you can't vote, so you can't vote them out. So it's almost like you're a slave.
Absolutely.
You're encamped. You're captive to the city that you're living in, because they have slapped you in jail, and then when you get out and they start abusing you, you can't say anything about it because they've taken away your right to say anything.
Absolutely. And here's the ironic part about that is that they know that already. So when the statement is made, we'll vote them out, you already know they can't vote. You know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. that's that manipulation, if you will, that deceptive actions and attitudes, and they already know what the law is for that state. They already know what the laws are. And they know the population. I can guarantee you they know the people who've been – they know the percentages of the people of that community that have been incarcerated, that may have felonies on their records, whatever the case is. So they already know nothing's going to change. But they say that to people to play upon people's ignorance. Well, you know what I mean? So the people that don't know any better, they think, well, yeah, why don't they do that? That is a game that's being played here.
Yeah. Let's look at some of the numbers. So, again, I'm reading from a March 3rd report from CNN Justice reporter Evan Perez, and it says that a Justice Department civil rights investigation has concluded that the Ferguson Police Department and the city's municipal court engaged in a pattern and practice of discrimination against African Americans, targeting them disproportionately, there's that term again,
yep,
for traffic stops, use of force, and jail sentences, according to a U.S. law enforcement official briefed on the investigation. It says that among the findings that CNN reviewed from 2012 to 2014, check this out, 85% of people subject to vehicle stops by Ferguson police were African American. 85%. 90% of those who received citations were black, and 93% of the people arrested were black. And then that's while 67% of Ferguson population is black. And then it goes on to say that in 88% of the cases in which the Ferguson police reported using force, it was against African Americans. 88% use of force against African Americans.
That's unbelievable.
Something is wrong with that.
Absolutely.
Says during 2012 to 2014, black drivers were twice as likely as white drivers to be searched during traffic stops, but 26% less likely to be found in possession of contraband. So, I mean, when you look at these types of situations, and this just raises, they say it's a systemic discrimination against African Americans in Ferguson. Ferguson is a microscopic view of what's going on in this nation, I think.
Absolutely.
You could probably pick any number of little towns anywhere in this country, and you will probably find some of the same types of disparity, the same type of disproportionate views on citations and so forth. When you have a chief of police in Ferguson, Missouri, who said that he was going to resign, and then he said he wasn't going to resign because he wanted to see how this all turned out. Well, when you're at the helm of a ship that is topsized, I mean, it's already flipped over. It just hadn't gone under yet. He should have left a long time ago.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the issue that you're looking at here, probably, I think you make a good point. If you think this is restricted to Ferguson, really stop and think again, because it's not restricted to Ferguson. This type of behavior, as we said, this word is becoming monotonous, but this is what it is. It is a culture that is set up in police departments all over this country. And Ferguson happens to be the police department where the magnifying glass was put on as a result of an innocent 18-year-old man being shot to death. That's why the attention has been shed on Ferguson. But I can guarantee you there's probably not a police department you can go to where you're not going to find this type of behavior, because racism is alive and well in America. That is the bottom line.
Well, when we come back, we're going to take a look at some of the most outrageous examples of police misconduct in the DOJ report on Ferguson. And then we're also going to jump to our main subject of the evening, wrongfully convicted on death row. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lamont Banks, Lisa Banks, and Cliff Stewart. Our phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
History is important because it shows where you're coming from and where you're going. Type 2 diabetes is something that runs in my family, which means I'm at risk. In fact, 1 in 3 American adults are at risk for developing type 2 diabetes. And knowing this, if I do nothing, that family history becomes my family's future. And my family is too important to me for that. Take the risk factor assessment today at AskGreenKnow.com.
My name is Brian Banks. In 2002, I was wrongfully convicted of a crime I did not commit. I know you hear that a lot, but in my case, it's true.
The California Innocence Project is a nonprofit clinic at California Western School of Law devoted to investigating and litigating cases where innocent people may have been wrongfully convicted. My name is Justin Brooks, and I'm director of the California Innocence Project. Since 1999, we've investigated thousands of cases. Where there's strong evidence of innocence, we go to court and we free our clients. Law students and law professors work together to seek justice in these cases. Over the past 14 years, we've been able to free many innocent clients. So if you or someone you know has been falsely convicted of a crime, or if you'd like to donate to our cause, then please contact the California Innocence Project at californiainnocenceproject.org.
The California Innocence Project had my conviction reversed, gave me my life back, and helped me fulfill my dream of playing in the NFL.
Please support the California Innocence Project and help bring home victims of an imperfect justice system.
Now it's time. Time to change the face of justice.
Did you know that minority and youth participation in juries is extremely low to non-existent?
The incidence of youth and minority offenders faced with trials has exploded.
Youth and minorities are not being represented as they should be.
We must represent for people to get fair trials.
If you acquire a state ID or driver's license, it allows you to register to vote.
And it allows you to become eligible for jury service.
If you're 18, a U.S. citizen with a state ID or driver's license, and registered to vote,
you're eligible to be called for jury duty.
If called and selected, make it your duty to serve.
We can't get justice without you. Change.
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 Change the face of justice.
Check your local county or state jury service website for further details.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. I was informed that I messed up on Lisa's last name earlier, so we're good.
No problem, Sam. Don't worry about it.
For more information about A Just Cause, we ask that you go to www.a-justcause.com. Click on the donate button. Also, we could use any assistance from you. A Just Cause is a 501c3. We ask that you also check with your financial advisor regarding any tax laws regarding your donations. And also on our website, you'll find helpful resources. One of the things that we often talk about here on the program are the IRP6, and we'll be talking about that a little bit later in the program as well. But we just want to invite you to, if you want to prepare for that, you can go to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org. There you can find in-depth information about the IRP6 case. And that's one of the things where we talk about as far as disparity and disproportionate sentencing and that type of thing. So we'll be talking about that. The IRP6 are David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. We ask that you just keep them in your prayers as well. Before the break, we said we were going to come back and talk about some of the outrageous examples of police misconduct that were identified by the DOJ report that came out this week on Ferguson. Now, according to Reuters, and a writer there, Joshua Lott, took a look at this situation, and he reported that the police department, or that DOJ report, paints the police department and the municipal court system in Ferguson as basically being driven by revenue rather than public safety needs, and said that they're engaged in a pattern and practice of unlawful conduct that violates the First, Fourth, and the 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution and federal statutory law. Just as one example, they're showing here that a lady received an African-American lady received a parking ticket, $151 fine. And she ran into some financial issues, ran and had a situation of homelessness over a period of time. That case is still pending from 2007. Well, now that fine has ballooned up to over $1,000. And they have tried, you know, she tried to work, you know, work with them on it. But, you know, that's one example. Another example is where they indicated that the Ferguson police, a guy was just waiting to catch the bus. And they called him over and put him in handcuffs. And had him sit there, had not given any reason for any reasonable suspicion to run checks or warrants. That's the way it's read here. They had no reason to detain him, but they threw handcuffs on him anyway and ran warrants, search warrants, and ran checks on him for warrants.
And this is because he's sitting at the bus stop.
While black.
Ah, there you go. While black. Got you.
And Sam, on the young lady that you mentioned prior to that gentleman, it said she made an attempt to make a $25 and a $50 payment on those fines. It says that the court returned those payments, refusing to accept anything less than payment in full. I am aware that in most places, there's a minimum of $25 that you are allowed to pay, and there is a collection or a collection department that sets you up on payment arrangements.
Uh-huh.
The fact that they denied this lady's payments, so an attempt was made to comply.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Now they says as of December 4, 2014, she's already paid $550, which is three times the amount that she even owed, and they're still saying she is still owed. They're still owed that $541. That is completely outrageous. And a lot of times the collection situation is based upon your income. If I'm unemployed, I don't have a job, I can't really make ends meet, we will work with you $25 minimum a month. That's in most counties across this country. And for that to be done, it definitely supports the argument that revenue is being put in the forefront versus public safety. And they wonder why people don't trust and have faith in the system. This definitely is an example of that.
Well, Lamont, and I'm reading as well in the same article that we're reading from, that the city council in, I guess this was in Ferguson as well, I believe, the city council voted to keep a municipal judge after one council member said the judge does not listen to testimony, does not review the reports or the criminal history of defendants, and does not let all the pertinent witnesses testify before rendering a verdict. Because why? The city can't afford to lose any efficiency in our courts nor experience any decrease in our fines and forfeitures.
Wow.
So I'm not gonna listen to everything that needs to be heard, because we might have to we might not get all of our fines that we're trying to collect from our citizens.
So you might as well close the courtroom down then. because if that's what your motivation is, that is, as Sam, as you said earlier, that is violation of the Constitution of the United States and due process, period.
Well, here's one that is also part of this report, and it is absolutely, you know, it's scary. Scary from the standpoint of these people can have this type of latitude, this type of license, if you will, to conduct or be conduct misconduct and not be held accountable. Here's one that says that the Ferguson police officers frequently fail to document arrests. It says that in Ferguson, officers will sometimes make an arrest without writing a report or even obtaining an incident number, and hundreds of reports can pile up for months without supervisors reviewing them. Officers' use of force frequently go unreported and are reviewed only laxly when reviewed at all. As a result of these deficient practices, stops, arrests, and uses of force that violate the law or Ferguson PD policy are rarely detected. And the DOJ identified several elements to this pattern of misconduct. You know, when you see this kind of thing, it baffles me, Lamont, as to how can they say that there is not a basis for filing a lawsuit against the city of Ferguson or against the Ferguson Police Department for civil rights violations. Well, I don't get it.
Well, here's what's insane about it. Before this report came out, you had everybody in Ferguson in authority, police officers, the chief of police, defending their police department, that there is no such thing. That is ludicrous. We do our very best to treat everybody fair, and they were irritated and offended by even the thought or the suggestion that there was something that was going wrong here. And then the story comes out, then you go to the point is how possibly have you not received an Oscar at the Academy Awards for your performance prior to this report coming out? That you're talking about, if you were sitting there watching these men, you would think, man, these men are really serious.
Yeah.
But the truth always comes out. And here you go.
Well, you can get more information on the misconduct that's reported on by the DOJ. Well, you can just about go to any news outlet. But for those of you who are following us, you can go to Reuters and pull up information there. And then also CNN, we were pulling information from there as well. So, you know, I'm sure that we will be talking about this one for several weeks to come, because I heard on the news today also that the Brown family is going to file a civil lawsuit against the police department there in Ferguson, even though the DOJ is not going to. So we will continue to follow that and see what happens there. Okay. So let's go on to our main subject of the evening, and that being wrongfully convicted on death row. Now, you know, recently the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, he basically stated that, you know, we may be executing innocent people. And so he has called for a halt to executions until after the Supreme Court finishes reviewing Oklahoma's procedure for lethal injections. And, you know, just in the last couple of days, I know the state of Georgia had a stay of execution for a lady there in the state of Georgia. And because of the use of the drug that they would use to execute her in the state of Texas, there was also a stay of execution for Rodney Reed. And so, you know, state after state after state are kind of, you know, they're getting kind of leery of the death penalty and the fact that you can potentially put an innocent person to death. Well, joining us this evening to talk about the subject of wrongfully convicted on death row, and we're going to talk about several other things associated with that, but joining us right now is Victoria Redstall. And Ms. Redstall is a freelance investigative reporter who looks into these types of cases, and she has some very interesting stories that she's written about and that she's followed, and some of them have gotten a lot of notoriety in the media. So we're going to ask Victoria to join us. Ms. Redstall, how are you doing this evening?
Very good indeed, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Well, so talk to us about your efforts as an advocate to, I won't call it an advocate. I'll let you kind of give us an idea of what the purpose is for you looking into wrongful convictions of people who may be sitting on death row. And would you call it advocacy, or are you just trying to ensure that the truth is exposed?
I'm actually trying to ensure the truth is exposed, and I never set out to do this. I'm actually a true crime author, and actually focus a lot. I've been focusing a lot on serial killers, which are the rightly convicted, let's just say, guilty as sin. Then I wrote a show, a pilot for a new TV show for the Biography Channel, or ID. I wanted to go out to every state in America to people who are about to be executed within, like, say, a week or two, and I wanted to get their last words. I got a guy on Oklahoma death row who claimed to be innocent, and I thought, okay, if this is the only guy who I'm going to talk to, let's make him the pilot episode, and let's just let him say he's innocent, okay? Do you know, I did not think, I was 98% certain he was guilty, as I thought all people in prisons are guilty, and how wrong I am, and how wrong I was, and it was Jeffrey David Matthews in Oklahoma death row that actually was the very person who has changed my life towards wanting to go after there are so many wrongly convicted. And it was because of him, knowing when I came back to Los Angeles, knowing he had only days to live, that I had to fight for this man's life. Not for the television, not for a book, not for anything, but just for the fact of humanity. Knowing this man's innocent, I had to do that. And I found the arresting officer within 3 days, yet apparently his public defenders were trying to find him for 17 years and never found him, living in a different state in Colorado. He went on camera for me on Skype because he's in Colorado. I'm in Los Angeles. And he said, I want to say, because how corrupt the justice system was in Oklahoma, convicting a man who was clearly innocent of the crime. And that's when I went after the governor. I wrote to the governor, the lieutenant governor, the pardon and parole board, the clemency board, the attorney general, and I sent the video of me speaking. I sent the video of Michael Mars, that was the arresting officer speaking, who had since retired. And I fought, and I got him a 30-day stay of execution. That then turned into another, the next time, a 60-day stay of execution. And then that turned into the third time. I got him, you know, more evidence. I kept getting my whole life consumed with making sure that this guy got off death row and walked free of the crime that he was accused of. And there are, and he wasn't even a minority. He was a white guy. And there are even more minorities that I would like to go after to help get them off death row, life in prison, or even a few years in prison. When someone's wrongly convicted, we've got to save these people. We've got to be the advocates because their lawyers don't do a good job.
So, Victoria, what was the tipping point in the Jeffrey David Matthews case?
The tipping point? What do you mean by the tipping point?
What was the one thing that stood out to you that made you say that this man is not guilty, this man is innocent? What did he say to you to make you come to that conclusion, or what evidence did you review that
evidence
made you come?
It's the evidence. Because everyone, I mean, 98% of people in prisons are all innocent. I mean, there's no one guilty in prisons if you go on what they say to you, right? So you've got to go on the court transcripts, the trial transcripts, the arresting officers, people like that. When I read those court transcripts and the trial transcripts, when I read what went down, and he had absolutely no motivation to kill his uncle. There was no motivation. The problem was he was a bit of a bad lot on a small scale. And he did have the motivation to rob his uncle in Oklahoma of the $75,000 in a storm cellar. But you know, in Oklahoma, sometimes I don't think right. And he goes and tells two people, doesn't he? So he said to the two people, we're going to go in on Saturday morning when my uncle's not around. So, of course, they were splitting the money three ways. You get it? Well, little did Jeff Matthews know that those two people went in on the Wednesday or the Tuesday morning, so they didn't have to split the money three ways, and they were related. I think they were brothers or cousins. And, of course, they cut Jeff Matthews out of the deal, knowing they'd done a dummy run on the Monday, saying that's the storm cellar, that's where the $75,000 is, that's what we're going to rob on the Saturday. And, of course, these two guys who are related to each other, they go in on the Tuesday or the Wednesday early hours of the morning. Jeff Matthews is asleep with his pregnant girlfriend at his phone. And, you know, although Jeff was doing the wrong thing and he was bad, he's a thief and all that stuff, he didn't kill anyone. He was a very gentle soul. He's a Jehovah's Witness, but a very gentle soul. Bad lot, but not a murderer. So he doesn't deserve to to be killed for it. That's the thing. He wasn't even there. It wasn't like he was in a getaway car. He wasn't even present.
Okay, and Victoria Lamont Banks here. Good to have you. Appreciate the work you're doing for the wrongfully convicted. I do have a question, and maybe this will stand to reason. It sounds like to me that the police involved here, based upon this gentleman's past, and I think you make a good point, whether he has a checkered past for criminal behavior or whatever, cops or police officers tend to say, well, if they were guilty of this type of improper behavior, perhaps they were also guilty, thus tagging them in a case just to close the case right out as quick as they can. And the public buys it because, well, you know, he did have a record, so he must be guilty. Does it seem like that they kind of, in your experience in dealing and researching the evidence and things along those lines, that they tend to lean towards people with a checkered past, whether they're guilty or not?
I would say, and I'm very pro-law enforcement, I happen to say that in states that are maybe a little bit backward, like Oklahoma, I would say even more so, but more corrupt. I wouldn't say that was pretty corrupt what happened, and I hate to say that cops were corrupt in this instance, but it's the justice system over the whole country that is so corrupt and are putting away innocent people. I actually spent quite a few hours today with someone, interviewing him for my next book, who happens to be a convicted felon who is a cop, a very high-powered cop, a lieutenant with a certain department. I won't say the name of the department, but there was an investigation that went on. He, I believe, is innocent of this. And seven cops, I won't say whether sheriff or police, but seven cops are going to prison, state crimes that they certainly didn't commit by following orders. But because a cop will say a cop is guilty, then that cop is guilty. It's kind of like a child molester. If someone says a man is a child molester, they don't have a say in the matter. You're guilty until proven innocent. And that's how it is with cops that are accused of a crime. You're guilty unless proven innocent because a cop found you guilty. In this case, it was a higher than a cop. It was, you know, that organization. We won't say the name on the radio. But my point is, I spent time with this person. He's not got the death penalty, but he's got just over 3 years in prison. They're out on appeal. That's why I spent time with him today. So there are so many people out here today or going to prison or in prison. I know another man in prison for a rape that he didn't commit in Soledad Prison. All these women want to come forward saying, oh, 8 years ago, he raped me. 4 years ago, he raped me. I'm tired of these poor men that get put away for rape when they rape nobody. These college football players out in the middle of nowhere, Tennessee, I think the last one is. These poor guys are accused of rape. And it's because, oh, she happened to be drunk. But what isn't allowed is evidence. The justice system's corrupt because they won't let you bring in the evidence that this female, this woman, had been sleeping with the guy for months before. It just so happened that night she was drunk. She's still sleeping with the same guy, and that guy invited his friends over. I mean, it's not rape. I'm sorry. I mean, what the justice system don't let happen is they don't let all the evidence come through. They pick and choose what they want. Solve the case, close the case, or whatever. And then, as you just said, they'll go after people who've got priors. It may be drugs or small petty theft or whatever it is. And they say, well, okay, we've got to find a guy. We'll close the case. So, I mean, someone needs to speak up here. And I'm only doing my part out of just humanity. I would love to do a show on this. And this is my first step to doing a show as a radio show with you.
And we appreciate that. I will tell you, I was wrongfully convicted here in Colorado for 7 years. For a case that was very much clear, very clearly presented that no crime had happened here. And it was a he said, she said type situation. And the evidence was so clear that the young lady was actually definitely lying and not telling the truth. When evidence came forward, was to be brought forward to the court that this was a blatant lie, which proved to be the case because my case was overturned by the Court of Appeals here. And I went through a new trial and was found not guilty. But the bottom line is they convicted me knowingly, knowing that that no crime even occurred here. But so it goes, and I'm going to what you're saying, and your passion is appreciated that, you know what, people are very quick to call. What about the victims, as you say? You got a lot of men that are victims of just targets and setups that, you know what, I don't really like you in my situation. A young lady didn't like me and didn't want me with her mother, so she said, I'm going to make this up so he doesn't have to be in the house anymore. As a result, I spent 7 years in prison wrongfully.
Oh, and my God.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I appreciate your position and what you're doing. We need people with that type of passion. It's very well appreciated.
Joining us, and I've certainly got it.
joining us this evening talking about wrongfully convicted on death row and her work that she's doing is Victoria Redstall. Victoria is a freelance investigative reporter. Victoria, if you would hang tight, let us take a quick break, and we'll be right back in a moment. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. If you'd like to join in on this conversation, please give us a call at 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We'll be right back.
Each week, A Just Cause Coast to Coast shares compelling stories about judicial injustice. But AJC doesn't leave it there. AJC Radio presents top guests from across the country who are advocates, activists, attorneys, and judges who provide insight into current events and the law. If you believe in what AJC is doing, we ask that you make a donation of any amount. Your kindness will be greatly appreciated. Go to www.a-justcause.com and click on the donate button. Again, please go to www.a-justcause.com and click on the donate button.
Picture this, a 75-year-old man convicted of murder waiting for his trial to finally go through. He's been on death row for 25 years now and finds out he's been wrongfully convicted and is completely innocent. Not only does this mean that 25 years of his life have been spent in jail for no reason, but that the actual murderer could still be out there right now. The bad thing is that this exact thing happens more often than you think, but you can help stop it by supporting our campaign to abolish the death penalty.
Can you imagine spending 20 years of your life in prison for a crime you didn't commit? Neither could I, until I got the opportunity to portray Betty Ann Waters in the film Conviction, telling the real story of how she freed her brother Kenny. Sadly, what happened to Kenny happens far more often than you might expect. But together, we can stop it. Please join me in helping the Innocence Project fight injustice. Go to innocenceproject.org to make a donation and get involved.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness
are all courtesy of the heroic men and women of the United States military.
They give so much, and they ask so little.
I'm Joe Bontania.
I'm Jack Scalia.
I'm Nick Searcy.
I'm Bonnie Jo Laughlin.
I'm Scott Elrod. Please help me thank our heroes by doing something.
Donate your time, talent, or gifts
to groups and organizations devoted to our troops and their families.
Visit a veteran's hospital.
A smile, a hug,
a shoulder, a handshake,
or even an attentive ear goes a long, long way.
Quite simply, give.
They'll sincerely appreciate it.
And it just might do wonders for you, too.
Remember, freedom isn't free.
Freedom isn't free.
Freedom isn't free. Get involved.
Give back now.
God bless America.
You are listening to AJC Radio.
You're tuned to A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976. Again, 347-838-8976. Joining us this evening is Victoria Redstall. And Victoria does investigative reports on the wrongfully convicted who are sitting on death row. And we were just, she was just sharing with us the situation of Jeffrey David Matthews. And again, welcome to the program, Victoria.
Thank you. Thank you again.
So, Victoria, so you were talking about Jeffrey David Matthews, and you helped in getting three stays of execution. And unfortunately, in 2011, when he was executed, what was the situation that led to that, and you know, how did the governor or the Department of Corrections, whoever made the decision there in the state of Oklahoma, that must have been very disheartening when that situation occurred.
Disheartening is the understatement of my lifetime, because this is what has propelled me into moving forward in this direction. I had saved him from death row, from the death penalty 3 times. I didn't save him the 4th time for the one reason that I was dealing with Governor Brad Henry, his wife, the lieutenant governor, but everything switched over when a new governor got on in the January of 2011. I didn't know that governor. I started to deal with her, obviously, those moments she got on, explaining what I'd been doing with Governor Brad Henry, and he was granting the stays of execution. But I feel that she just looked at my videos and Michael Mars's videos and the documents and thought, hold on, this guy's had 3 stays of execution, and we still haven't got the profound evidence that we need. I'm sure that's how she thought. We cannot give him a 4th stay. It's never happened in the history of America. And she killed him on 11-1, 2011. Sorry, 11-1, 2011. She killed him on 11th of January, 2011. And I never can get over it. I mean, I'm close to his mother then, and I'm even closer to her now. So I know her well. It was her only child. I'm not going to say her name because she wants to always keep that private. But, I mean, how devastating. I knew he was innocent. And I'm pretty sure Governor Brad Henry did as well. But the new governor knew nothing of the history of the case. And she got on, and she just couldn't give him another 4th stay. I mean, part of me obviously felt like I didn't do my job good enough, but I did my best at the time with the resources I had and also with the resources I didn't have. So that's why I want to work with the Innocence Project. I want to, you know, do more radio shows, TV shows. I want to show how passionate I am about those that are wrongly convicted, because there's too many in America.
And, Victoria, this is Cliff Stewart. Thank you for being on the show. I wanted to, when you say that you felt like you didn't do enough, the thing that it brings to mind to me is that even those who advocate for justice and do everything that they can, when the system is corrupt, it basically fights you, forces you into a corner, keeps you from being, just basically being a champion at what you're trying to do. Now, the best thing that could have happened is if you would have been successful in getting him released from prison. But like you say, the new governor comes in and says, you know, I'm not going to make history. I'm not going to let history be rewritten on my watch, which her issue, what her statement should have been is, I'm going to ensure justice in everything on my watch. And it brings me or reminds me of the case of Sabrina Butler, who was in Mississippi. She was the first woman ever to go on death row. She got convicted of basically murdering her infant child. And the worst part about this, the same day her child dies, she gets arrested, comes to find out that she was trying to do CPR on an infant. She didn't know how to do CPR. All she knew is, my baby's dying. I need to try to do something. Seemingly he's choking to death. He's not breathing. Come to find out that the baby had a kidney disease, and that was the cause of his death. The prosecutor in the case went after her, basically convicted her, and 30 days after her conviction had her scheduled to be executed. I mean, this was before the appeal could be done. He had everything laid out that by the time you get to your appeal, you will be dead. So he didn't care about the fact that, okay, new evidence may come up. There may be a coroner's report, autopsy that'll come up. That was not his concern. His concern was, I have my conviction. I can get an execution and make the public feel good about a baby that died. Someone was held accountable. And so what happens is, with the corruption, then justice can never be served, because corruption is the roadblock to justice. It gets in the way of people who are trying to do the right thing, of people who are trying to ensure that, like you said, you know, when you have a serial killer and you have someone who says, yes, you know, I've been doing this. I am a criminal. I belong in prison. That's what the prisons basically are made for, are the people who just refuse to stop committing crime. But to have a mother who's already grieved of her child and then to put her on death row, to say within 90 days you're going to be dead, I'm not going to even give you a chance at appeal, that is the type of corruption that keeps justice from happening. And my thing is, when we find those type of prosecutors with that type of misconduct, Why do we give them immunity? Why don't we? Why wasn't that prosecutor taken and says, okay, you need to be put in prison for 20 years? You tried to take someone's life. You deserve to be put in prison. So I wanted to kind of get your take on prosecutorial and judicial immunity and how it basically sets the scale of justice, basically offset, that the prosecutors can do whatever they feel like and know that they're not going to be held accountable for it.
Yeah, there are no repercussions for the prosecution. And the thing is, I feel if there's more repercussions for these kind of prosecutors, which are quite a lot of them, it would be a deterrent for them to try to go after people who are wrongly convicted. But there are no repercussions. So if they, you know, if they get someone convicted and then it was proven that they were wrong, they do not get a slap on the wrist. They don't even get that. When I feel they should go to prison, as what you've just said. So the thing is, where the justice system, again, is wrong, is there's no repercussions. So there's no deterrent. So they're going to keep going doing this.
Right. I mean, they won't even fine them for breaking the law or going outside the realms of their job to get a wrongful conviction. I mean, when you look at the report that was done by the Exoneration Project last year, that last year was a record year for exonerations. And there were so many of those that were exonerated from, pleading guilty. So many of those that were exonerated that there wasn't even a crime committed. So many of those exonerated where the DNA proved that they were innocent. And then there were those who were on death row that were exonerated. It's like, okay, you have people on death row that never committed a crime. And all the prosecutors are trying to do, I mean, even when the evidence comes up, it never ceases to amaze me that when DNA evidence comes up, that a prosecutor will still fight and say, no, I want to retry this person. They need to stay in prison. I don't want the DNA evidence. If you have the evidence that shows this person is innocent, why would you then fight against that? Why wouldn't you say, okay, hey, if the evidence is there, let's let this person out right now? We don't even need to hold a hearing. We don't need to wait until tomorrow. We need to tell the judge that, hey, my recommendation is to let this person out. I'm talking to the governor. We need to get this person out of prison. They never committed a crime. But you find the exact opposite thing with these prosecutors, that they are trying their best to keep a person in prison that the evidence shows that they are innocent. And especially when it's someone on death row, how do you say a person that's on death row, the evidence proves that they didn't do it? Why would you continue to fight to take that life?
Simply because they're trying to save face, ego, and they're trying to save face because they don't get any repercussions. They don't get punished for it. So they're just trying to save face and create a problem. It's almost like they're vindictive and they just want to make a person's life even more miserable. When they think they're free, then goes back again and they're not free because the prosecutor wants to retry them. So it's vindictiveness. It's to save face. It's to not admit the fact that they were wrong. Horrible. It's a broken justice system here. I mean, there are so many parts of this justice system that is broken. It needs people like me and you that are passionate about it to actually stand up against them or go to the high court and say, what are the repercussions going to be for these prosecutors that do this? There's so many of them. And then people who are innocent will settle for a deal because they're so afraid that their real evidence cannot be brought in to a trial. So they'll settle for a deal on a lesser charge when they really shouldn't be held accountable for admitting guilt on any level.
That's
there
exactly
are people sitting in prisons today. It's shocking.
Yeah, because the Exoneration Project, that report that they did, showed that there were, like, I think, like 38% of the convictions were people who did plea deals, who basically said, yes, I admitted I was guilty. And the reason that they did a plea guilt is because the prosecutors have basically explained to them that, look, I have the power to destroy your life. Either you take a plea deal for 10, 20 years, or I will put you in prison for 8 consecutive life sentences on some trumped up charges. So they never even fight it because they've come to realize that the prosecutors have all this power to basically destroy their life, take it away, like I said, 8 times over again. And they have no way to fight it, so they just plead guilty. And for the exoneration report to come out and say this many people pled guilty, but we found that they were innocent. There wasn't even any evidence against them. It's totally ridiculous. And we're going to go to the phone real quick, Victoria. We have Burl on the line. How you doing, Burl?
Hi, great to hear your voice. This is Burl Bear. Pleasure to hear the program this evening. This is one hot topic. Now, I'm here in California, you know, where the report came out on what they termed an epidemic of prosecutorial misconduct in this state. And I haven't lived here all that long, about 10 years or so. I wasn't all that shocked. I was born and raised in Washington State, and being a true crime investigative journalist, I've seen horrifying things. I'm sure your guest there has also. I've seen blank pieces of paper where the police will hand it to the person and say, just sign this, we'll fill in the rest of the page. I've seen confessions where the name is misspelled and it's not the person's signature. I mean, it boggles the mind. There was one case up in Tacoma where the prosecutorial misconduct was so severe that the judge threw a temper tantrum in the courtroom, said, this case is giving me Excedrin headache number 850, and he stormed out of the courtroom. But still, nothing was done to the prosecutor except the defense attorney was so mad, he ran against him in election and won.
Wow.
But every time I do a radio show also on Saturdays on Outlaw Radio, and I have prosecutors on, I always ask them, have you been pressured by your superiors to prosecute someone that you in your heart believe didn't do it? And with the exception of one, they all said yes.
And that is so sick. I mean, that just shows that the corruption is from the top down. I mean, where does it stop?
These people, they want to go on their conviction ratios. You know, we've got this many convictions. It's like when you talk about Giuliani. You know, the reason he got so many convictions is not because of his prosecutorial zeal, is he'd make the people sit in prison or jail for a year before he brought them to trial. They'd be so fed up being in jail, they'd take a plea agreement.
Exactly, and that's how they maintain their 98% conviction rate. It's not off of the merits of the law. It's off of the misconduct, the corruption, like you said, to keep a person sitting in a cage and say, you know what, you sit here in this cage for a year, and then the next time we ask you if you did it, if you say yes, we'll go ahead and get you out of this cage. Then we'll put you in a larger box.
Bigger cage. But, a bigger cage.
But, until then, you're going to sit here until you say that you did it. I mean, that's beyond coercion. That's torture.
Yeah. So, can you imagine, I bet she can speak to this, PTSD for people falsely accused, and even worse, if they're falsely imprisoned for a crime they didn't commit. Now, I was once accused of doing a heinous deed, which I didn't do. It didn't go to court, but it severely impacted my reputation because, you know, whispering campaigns. It, you know, there was something I'd never done. The person was mentally ill, and they just made up something, and, you know, it haunted me for years. We're very eager to believe all sorts of horrible things about people. But even the situation here in California where there is I think Dateline does something on this, three white guys in an Oldsmobile did a home invasion, killed a bunch of people, and got away. And they were looking for these three guys until they found out there was a black man who'd escaped from prison, who was a car thief, staying down the road. They stopped looking for the three white guys, arrested the black guy, and railroaded him despite an eyewitness saying, no, that's not the guy. And he's still in prison. And the governor won't let him out because it looks bad to pardon someone who was convicted of killing four people, including children.
Oh, God. What state was that in, Bo?
California.
Oh, my gosh. So he's got life in prison, that guy.
Yeah. And for killing a man and his wife and the two kids and a guest, and one of the kids lived and said, no, that's not who did it. It's not that man. And there were even witnesses who saw the three white guys and they also deal with dumping their bloody clothes, one thing or another. But once they had this guy, oh boy, if we got a Negro somewhere we can prosecute, you know, it's just astonishing.
Oh, God, I would love to have his name and, you know, help him out, especially in California.
There's a book. The book is called Scapegoat.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't write it. Someone else wrote it, but I can look it up and get back to you on it if you'd like, because I have the author on my show.
Well, actually, I'm a friend of yours on Facebook, Bill.
So oh, good.
You can look me
okay,
up.
Okay, so I know who you are and you know who I am. It's good
yeah,
to have friends.
Yeah,
so,
good to have
Victoria,
Facebook.
Victoria, another question for you. So, you know, we've talked quite a bit about your work on investigating wrongfully convicted on death row. Do you also investigate other cases that don't necessarily involve death row cases?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I spent quite a number of hours today with a man who is quite high up in a law enforcement department, he's a lieutenant actually, who has been sentenced to a considerable number of years in prison and convicted of a crime that I do not believe, nor do a lot of people believe, that he committed. There's no way. He followed the orders of his superiors. And a certain, let's say, other law enforcement agency, which is above this law enforcement agency, accused him of conspiring against them. And he followed orders. He did everything protocol. It was everything he did was right. He's a good man. I've known him for 20 years, a good family man and a good cop. And he's one of seven, he was the highest ranking position, have been sentenced to prison for a crime that none of them committed. So that's my next book. And coincidentally, I spent a number of hours with him today. This is a white-collar crime. This will be a federal prison. And
Yeah. So,
yes, it's not just death row cases. As I said, we've got this person today who's a cop who's accused of a crime he didn't commit. There's a guy that I know in Soledad prison who's, I can say his name, Alex Da Silva, accused of rape by lots of different women, not ladies, women, who had sex with him countless times. And then one time they decided to say he raped them when he never did. I mean, and of course came to say this years later, I might add, I'm sorry, but when you're raped, don't you usually say something at the time? Or there's some kind of trauma, or you tell a friend. What the proof is with Alex Da Silva is these people, these women, kept calling him afterwards and trying to check in with him, calling him late at night. And the phone records weren't allowed entered into evidence to protect him. I mean, I'm sorry, to defend him. So those phone records proving that these people who he raped were calling him and texting him, saying, hi, what's going on? He just used them and dumped them. That's for sure. When women behave like they're loose, of course men use them and dump them because that's what they are. They're not exactly worth anything. So, yes, Alex used to dump them, but he didn't rape them, please God in heaven. But because women, not ladies, women are vindictive by nature. That's not all females. That's the women part of the word female, okay? I'm being very careful with my wording. So the women part of the females are usually quite vindictive. And because they've been used to dump yet again, they want to go after the poor man and say that man raped them. And when they can get another bloody woman to jump on the bandwagon and say, oh, he raped me too, then this poor guy goes down. And plus, he can't enter any of this into evidence. Maybe he was a player. He used and bonked women that were out to be used and bonked. Period. Not raped.
How could they?
Oh,
how
my
could
God,
they,
sorry, I'm getting heated.
Withhold the evidence?
They withheld the evidence. They withheld the evidence. He had a public defender. The defender said, oh, we can't enter that into evidence. The truth is, the public defender didn't go to Sprint.
Yeah.
Wait, hold on. Sprint was his cell phone. I know all about this. Sprint was his cell phone, okay, cell phone provider. And the public defender said they lost the records. Listen, with enough money, Sprint will find those records. I mean, somebody who's a lawyer is good. And then there's so many twists and turns in this Alex Da Silva case. Alex Da Silva was a judge and a producer on So You Think You Can Dance. He's a good man. I know his mother, but that has nothing to do with it. I know him, and I know that I can stand by the fact he's innocent, and I can.
Well, can I tell you something real quick? In Linwood, yeah. Washington, which is just a municipal court, you know, it's not big crimes, the public defender is only there if you're pleading guilty because they only have to work so many hours a day. So they stack the morning with all the people who are pleading guilty. After the lunch break, when the people who are pleading not guilty, the public defender has put in his requisite number of hours, and he's not there. Now, I happened to be arrested once in my life for a DUI, driving under the influence, except I don't drink, and I passed the test, but they arrested me anyway. Cost me about over $7,500 to beat that. But I asked the prosecutor, the public defender, why aren't you here to defend the people who need defense? He says, we like the people who have enough respect for the system to plead guilty.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, that was shocking to me. Because most Americans, I had this idealized thing in my head that people are actually looking for justice. And the prosecutorial code is one that they're looking for justice, not victories. But that's not the reality of the situation.
Wow.
I've seen too many. I mean, even just look at well-known cases like Geronimo Pratt, 27 years in prison, and everyone in the L.A. prosecutor's office knew he was innocent, and the judge knew he was innocent. You know, that just astonishes me.
Victoria,
it's shocking.
Victoria, do you have a few minutes?
Go ahead.
I do.
Okay, yeah, and Burl, I appreciate it. You were getting ready to go right to where I was going, and we appreciate you dialing in, Burl, and good to talk to you again. But Burl was getting ready to bring up about the IRP6. And I know, Victoria, you know, as far as looking at cases that are non-death penalty type cases, and then also the IRP6 being a white-collar case, we're going to share a little bit of information with you, Victoria, on that when we come back. And Burl is well-versed on that as well. We've been on his program, and he's been on ours before. So if you don't mind hanging in there just for a few more minutes when we come back, we're going to talk about the IRP6. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere. At the inception of A Just Cause Coast to Coast, the host and crew decided to devote a segment of each show to an exoneree moment. The purpose of the exoneree moment was to outline the case and highlight the circumstances that led to a wrongful conviction. AJC Radio also wanted to highlight the successes and failures of the justice system, understanding why the system failed and what ultimately turned the tide and cleared their name. We wanted to hear the personal first-hand accounts. They were appalling, emotional, astounding, and overwhelming. Lives devastated by the system. Most of the people who shared their stories were released from the building, but not from the system. They struggled to get their records expunged and clear their names, find suitable employment and housing, obtain restitution from the state, and reconnect with their families and friends. And it hardly fit the definition of exonerated, which means to free from guilt of blame, to clear from a charge of guilt or fault, to exculpate. These are the stories of lives taken and returned, but must be rebuilt, adapted, reestablished, and transformed. The profile of a wrongly convicted.
Today's profile features Cynthia Summer. In February 2002, 23-year-old Todd Summer, a Marine with no previous health problems, fell ill in San Diego, California, and died a few days later. The death certificate stated the cause of death was a heart attack. In 2003, the military tested some of Summer's tissues preserved from the autopsy and found fatal levels of arsenic in his body. Investigators believe that Cynthia Summer, Todd's wife, had poisoned him in order to collect more than $250,000 in insurance benefits and $1,900 per month in survivor benefits. Cynthia Summer was arrested in Florida in November 2005 and extradited to California in 2006. In January 2007, a jury convicted Summer of first-degree murder with the special circumstances of murder by poison and murder for financial gain, which made her eligible for a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. In November 2007, before Summer was sentenced, the same judge who presided over her trial vacated Cynthia's conviction and granted her a new trial. In April 2008, based on new lab tests, the prosecution asked the court to dismiss the charges against Summer, and she was released. Summer filed a $20 million lawsuit alleging a conspiracy to wrongfully prosecute her. The lawsuit was dismissed in December 2013. Summer sought compensation from the state of California, but that, too, was denied. This has been a profile of the wrongly convicted with AJC Radio.
You
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Joining us this evening are Victoria Redstall, and also dialing in is Burl Bayer. And Victoria, we were talking about some of the work that you've been doing regarding investigating cases of wrongfully convicted, of the wrongfully convicted. And in the situation of non-death penalty type cases, we briefly, just before the break, talked about the IRP-6, and this is a case where Burl is very familiar with as well. And that's one of the main cases that we work on at A Just Cause. And the IRP-6 are David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. And we always invite our listeners to go out to freetheirp6.org to look at information about that case. And, you know, Victoria, this is a case where all of the evidence, even prior to even getting an indictment, everything points to the fact that this is a debt collection case. And it's more than just the evidence that points to it. It's what the truth is, that this is a debt collection case, a corporate debt collection case that got criminalized by a rogue FBI agent, an overzealous, a rogue federal prosecutor by the name of Matthew Kirsch. And you have situations in the trial where their Fifth Amendment was violated. Expert witnesses were not allowed to testify. Speedy trial was violated. And the most egregious of all the acts is the transcript whereby the judge violated the gentleman's Fifth Amendment right. That transcript has never, never appeared at the court's, at the clerk's office. And there's so much in that transcript that would exonerate these men. And so, you know, these are the types of things that investigators, crime writers, and crime broadcasters like Burl and others, and we talk about it here, and we want you to you know, once your plate gets a little bit of room on it, I want you to look into it as well, where you have six men who are currently sitting in federal prison. They have been sitting there now for almost 3 years, and a mound of evidence that points to the fact that these men should not be sitting there.
Yeah. I mean, I firmly believe in what you're saying, and I think it's because the evidence that they had was not allowed to be entered into the trial. That's what I was saying earlier on and what we've all agreed upon. That's what's so criminal about the prosecution and the justice system. Why couldn't that evidence have come through? Why not?
Well, and even in this case, Victoria, there were two grand juries. You have one grand jury that looked at all of the evidence that was presented, even one of the IRP-6, Dave Zappolo, took in evidence to the grand jury and asked, you know, do you want to see what IRP Solutions was all about? And IRP Solutions, by the way, they developed a software that is critical to law enforcement in this nation. It would come in handy right now as the federal law enforcement agencies are having to deal with the ISIS situation. And Dave Zappolo took in information as to what the company was doing, what the company practices were all about. And that first grand jury said, why are we even looking at this? This is a debt collection case. Well, the federal prosecutor didn't like that answer, so he impaneled a second grand jury and got an indictment. And then, you know, the rest, as they say, is history as far as when you look at all the other egregious acts that took place during this trial and during this case. And it took forever for it to go to trial, and it was tried in 2011. The men have been incarcerated now since 2012, but we as A Just Cause, we will continue to fight on their behalf because of the fact that, you know, it's wrong. It is a wrongful conviction that no one should be sent to prison for something that's not a crime.
I know.
Go ahead, Jer.
On a bell to speak.
Oh, yeah, you go ahead. If you have something to say, you're the guest. Go ahead, speak.
I think we're both the guests. What was the question? No, I think we're both the guest.
Well, I look at this, and I had a big discussion with a fellow who used to handle security for State Department and has had lots of, shall we say, high-level dealings over the years. And I mentioned that I was doing a book on the IRP6 case. And it's unusual to do books on white-collar crime cases, wrongful things. It doesn't have the blood and guts that a lot of people like in true crime, but I find it fascinating, and I think it's important. And he said, well, you better be careful, because if they decide that they want to mess with you, look at that with Gary Webb with, Dark Alliance, killed himself with two blasts from a shotgun for getting out of hand. I look at this, and my first response was, why? It wasn't just a matter of a prosecutor thinking he has a criminal case and very zealously pursuing it and crossing the line. It appears to me, and I could be mistaken, but it appears to me that the goals of this were established long before it went to the grand jury. And the activity of when the place was raided, supposedly they were coming in to get financial records, the FBI. They weren't looking for financial records. It seemed to me, a layman, they're going for looking for the software. It looked to me as if it were a software grab, and this was a reason to do it. And when I talked to other people in the software industry who were familiar with this type of thing, they go, yeah, that's what it looks like. And you got to figure the Department of Homeland Security had already been ripped off for significant amounts of money. They almost paid out $60 million to a fellow on a bogus software system out of Los Angeles that was a complete fraud. And if he had gotten in a car wreck with a Lamborghini, whatever it was, on Malibu, they never would have known. But, when you go to court, you're the lawyer. I mean, you talk about means and motives and opportunity. I guess you don't have to prove motive. But there's so much wrong with the prosecution in this case. And the behavior indicates a motive on the behalf of the prosecutor and law enforcement that has nothing to do with debt collection. And
absolutely,
that's what I find scary.
Yeah, and Burl, when you look at it, I mean, you hit the nail right on the head, because you say, what is the prosecutor really going after? And furthermore, what is the crime that was committed here? And how is it that the FBI gets involved in debt collection? None of those things make any sense when you look at the IRP 6 case. And to have a grand juror that first says, you know what, this is a debt collection case, and I'm not going to give you an indictment, because if I do, then you can come after me for debt.
Right.
Then you also had the FBI, that when one of the staffing companies made an inquiry to the FBI saying, hey, I've been doing business with this company, they haven't paid me, I need you guys to investigate. And well, when the FBI did their investigation, they sent a response back to that company saying, look, this is a civil matter, this is a debt case, there's nothing we can do as the FBI, we don't get involved with debt. And this is a letter that was shown to the judge that says, look, even the FBI, in their own words, written, said that this is a case that needs to be taken up in civil court. Then you have the FBI agent, who was the special agent in charge, who investigated the entire case, who, at the very beginning of the case, he lied, with subject matter experts working in the business that were former federal employees that basically wrote an affidavit to him saying, look, I'm working here. I see the product. They're doing business. I'm going to stay on board. This is a real company. He still gets a search warrant that says this is a purported software company. So basically, they're a front company. They're not building anything. When that didn't work, the prosecutor went after another story. But this same FBI agent his testimony on the record in front of the judge says, If the debt had been paid, that this case would not be in trial. If IRP Solutions had paid their debt, we would not have been in trial. So that there you have three separate entities saying this is a debt collection case.
So ask the lawyer, where do you go from there? I mean, it hasn't flown on appeal. Who do you go to? Who do you go to complain about a corrupt system, except the people in the corrupt system? That's why you had the mafia. if you can't trust the police, you have to have your own code of justice. Well, it's tragic that the United States of America is so corrupt that you can't get justice.
Well, and I think Lamont Banks here chiming in on this. I think this, as in the big picture,
down to Victoria's passion for what she does and what she is finding out in regards to wrongful convictions, even to the point of death row, that if the actions of a court are blatant enough to do what they have done, not only in the IRP 6 case, but in several cases, that, as was said earlier, an epidemic is happening here. I think it all ties in together, that if a court has no boundary or stopping point, and the government is not stopping the government, and these courts, the federal courts, and things that are going on, and it's allowed to be done, then you are going to see, and if they can do it in a criminal proceeding, they're going to do it consistently in sentencing for death row. I mean, this is just a trend that's happening here. So I think all the points come together very, very clearly, that whether it's a white-collar crime, whether it's a drug crime, whether it's a murder trial, whatever it is, the court system and the justice system is out of control. I read in the news today where, based upon the findings of Ferguson and that injustice that is going on down there, that the
systemic, systemic to the entire area, to the department, been going on for years.
Absolutely. Now, the Congressional Black Caucus has said, again, based upon those findings, we know members of Congress are saying it is time for judicial reform. And again, I think it's unfortunate that people have to die before we wake up and say, hey, change has to happen. But nevertheless, change has to come. And I think that comes through, again, a Just Cause, organizations like Victoria and what we're doing, and the gentlemen, you know, people coming together writing books and doing the things to expose the situation as what it is and call it what it is.
Yeah, but you know, what's problematic is that we have become, as someone said, a spectator society. You cannot get Americans organized in their own best interest. You know, organize. You know, they're sitting back and watching things happen, and they're so misinformed about half of the things anyway. That okay, well, what's next on TV? You know, as the rights are eroded, as the justice evaporates. Of course, we operate under the delusion or the illusion, whichever one it is, that things were less corrupt before. No, we just didn't realize how corrupt it was.
I mean, absolutely.
You know, they talk about, there's a great study I read, and maybe you gentlemen and lady have read this one. It's called A Slow Lynching, The Slow Lynching of the American Black Man, on how the incarceration rates, the disparity in sentencing. And this is written by a judge who had some of his decisions go before the Supreme Court on whether he had to go along with the sentencing guidelines when he didn't want to, because he thought they were ridiculous. You know, 100-to-1 ratio of crack to powder, you know, a cocaine case. He says, that's not right. You know, what would be mandatory sentencing? And when the judges are complaining, you know it's really got to be bad.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, Victoria, what kind of timeline are you on as far as some of the other work that you're doing?
Oh, God, I'm doing a ridiculous amount of work. I mean, I shot a commercial this morning. I spent, you know, most of the day with this person who I believe is wrongly convicted, which is my next book. I'm focused very much on this law enforcement officer and the rest of the six outside of him to focus on my next book. And I'm up for a huge show that takes me away from L.A. for 3 months at least, which is going to make me relocate, which is what I want to do, which has nothing to do with murder, crime, law enforcement, or any of my normal stuff. So my time frame is I'm exceptionally busy, but I can put time aside if you want me to join something. I'd like to be able to be part of something. I remember Bell I was going to be on his show, but Bell didn't know this because I was introduced to him by Dan Szepanski. What are you asking me? Tell me what you're asking me, and I'll be specific.
No, that's what I was asking, and you know, if we have something come up, because you know, we from time to time we'll have different specific programs like this where we're talking about the wrongfully convicted being on death row, or if we decide we want to have a particular panel or something like that, we would like to reach out to you and get your involvement.
Always reach out to me. I'm at the end of the phone. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And then we're also looking at the possibility, we've been in the works, and I know, Burl, we've talked to you about the possibility of some of this as well, with doing something like a documentary or something like that on the IRP 6 case, because this case is so intriguing, and it is just filled with every type of disparity that you can think about, from the front end of this case all the way through to the status where we're at right now. And so, you know,
You know, I always think, look at it from the standpoint of the prosecutor, and, you know, you kind of try to put their hat on. How are they thinking? What's their response going to be? You know, people could, when they're wrong, they can promptly admit it, go, oh, gee, we made a tragic error here, so sorry. Or if the cover-up goes all the way to the top, if it's going to a federal level because there's, you know, federal interests involved or good old boy interests involved, as I said when you guys were on my show, it may be one of those, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. You're screwed. And even if they let these guys out, they may drag the thing out, so when they get out, it's at the end of their sentence. You know, I mean, you have to be psychologically and emotionally prepared for how bad the game's going to be.
And Victoria Lamont Banks here, all I would ask of you, you know, your passion has made an impact, I believe, on our listeners tonight and on us in this studio. If you get an opportunity to read into the IRP 6 case, and let your heart follow wherever it takes you. I believe it will prompt you to probably even dig even deeper. But we'd appreciate that, any type of looking into. And if you need information from us on that, we'd be more than happy to pass it on to you as you look into the miscarriage of justice that took place in that case.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Victoria.
Thanks for having me on. Thank you.
Thank you, Burl, also for dialing in. Thank you for your time this evening. This is the Justice
Prime Hottie on my show.
Say again, Burl.
So they're going to get this crime hottie on my show.
Oh. I'll send you a message, Belle.
Okay,
you're very
great.
Sweet. Thank you, both of you, and I appreciate it.
All right, thanks to you both. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we get education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. 8976. We're going to post excerpts of the interview with Victoria Redstall and Burl Bear on AJCRadio.com. So hang tight. We'll be right back after this break. Don't go anywhere.
Thanks for listening to AJC Radio. Call in at 347-838-8976 and share your stories and comments about judicial injustice. Be a part of the AJC Radio Show every Tuesday and Thursday night, 6 p.m. Mountain, 8 p.m. Eastern. The number again, 347-838-8976 or www.blogtalkradio.com and search for A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Over a million people are sitting in the prisons of America for nonviolent offenses. That's why I'm asking you to join the American Civil Liberties Union and help us in the fight to end mass incarceration. We spend over $80 billion a year incarcerating people. Alternatives to prison, like community service, drug treatment, and rehabilitation, costs less and can turn lives around. It's time for fair justice. It's time for smart justice. And we need your help.
I'm an actor, and that qualifies me to talk to you about social issues. And even though my opinion is controversial, I believe that racism is wrong. Now today, what I would like you to do is take a look at your skin color and hug somebody that has a different color skin. We can stop racism together, one hug at a time. Definitely ask permission before you hug somebody. Thank you.
How often does our justice system get it wrong, convicting innocent people of crimes they did not commit? a new project by the University of Michigan Law School and the Center for Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University School of Law tries to answer that question. In the last 23 years, more than 2,000 people have been convicted of serious crimes and later exonerated, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. By far, the largest segment was almost 1,200 defendants falsely convicted because of large-scale patterns of police corruption, generally in drug and gun cases. Of the remaining 873 defendants exonerated, nearly half were wrongly convicted of murder, and of that group, 101 were sentenced to death. On average, it took more than 11 years for a conviction to be set aside. Why does the justice system get it wrong? In homicides, the biggest problem is perjury and false accusation, most often by supposed eyewitnesses. False convictions in adult rape cases are primarily based on mistakes by eyewitnesses, while false convictions in child sex abuse cases are often for fabricated crimes that never occurred. 2,000 exonerations may seem small in a nation with more than 2.3 million people behind bars, but there are far more false convictions than the report contains. Most false convictions are never formally challenged, and those convictions that are successfully overturned receive little or no attention from the media, according to the report's authors.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Thanks for hanging in there and listening to our program this evening as we talk about wrongful convictions and the injustice that needs to be fixed in the land. And, you know, during the break, we were talking about the need to do away with the death penalty. I mean, we've talked about it on the program before, where whenever you have the potential of the of an innocent person being put to death, then that's one person too many that is executed. I mean, the same thing applies as to a person being wrongfully convicted and being incarcerated wrongfully. One person is too many. And so, you know, Lamont, as we talk to lawmakers and other advocates, what are you hearing as far as different types of efforts that that are underway as far as trying to, you know, reform our judicial system?
Well, it seems to be something that, at least from what we've heard from lawmakers on Capitol Hill, that people are concerned about. These are constituents. The constituents of these members of Congress are crying out. America is crying out for change. And I think that from what I've heard, we did see yesterday, based upon the, as I stated earlier, the ruling in Ferguson, that the Congressional Black Caucus, Congressman Butterfield, came forward saying even more now that the importance of judicial reform is urgent to be done now. Members of Congress, these are meetings that are going on because it's a consistent, I believe it's kind of like something that has fired really out of control in this country. And now at this point, unfortunately, as a result of lives being lost, people being killed, people are saying, what is going on in America? Well, Congress's job is to legislate and to pass laws to keep the homeland safe and to keep Americans feeling comfortable to call this place home. And if you got cops and people in authority and you know and judges and prosecutors just going totally against, basically going rogue, doing whatever they want to do, that feeling of America is going to be gone. It's going to be that feeling of safety, if you will, of security in the United States is going to be gone. I think that's what lawmakers are seeing and sensing from people across this country, that there's a sense of tension. Where the song goes on to say America is the home of the free. Well, at the home of the free, I don't feel worried about anything. Well, that's exactly the opposite in this country right now. And I believe that is the motivating factor. The Michael Browns, the Eric Gardners, the Trayvon Martin, the 12-year-old kid that was shot on a swing set. It's to the point of out of control. And I think, honestly, that's why Congress is talking and Congress is listening to what people are having to say at this point.
So basically what we're advocating for is federal legislation to make the death penalty or to take the death penalty off the table. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, I would think that's something that has to happen.
Because right now it's at the state level, right?
Yeah. But I think the federal government, I had this comment or conversation with one of the meetings on Capitol Hill stating that because the numbers reflect what they reflect, as far as the human error that is happening here, not only the human error, but the level of corruption by people in positions of authority, you cannot have the death penalty on the table as an option when they are saying there are, I forget the numbers, Cliff, maybe you can help me there, the number of people or percentages of people that are likely to be innocent on death row or who have been on death row and who have already died.
I think it's like 1 in 25.
Right. I mean, and they did that study, and if it was 1 in 100 of the people that are there, I mean, you kill an innocent person. And to know that, okay, there's with the statistics, with all of the record exonerations from last year, the amount of those people who are on death row, the likelihood of innocent people being on death row is very, very real. How do you continue to say, okay, we need to keep death row going? And sure. That's why, I believe Attorney General Eric Holder had to say, look, we got to put a stop on this until we figure out what's going on. Not only that they keep botching executions and making people, causing cruel and unusual punishment and suffering to a person when, if you're going to kill a man, at least make it swift and painless. You're taking away his life. I mean, I don't believe in the death penalty. I don't believe that killing one person is going to bring another person back. That's just my personal opinion. But until it gets until you come up with something that says, okay, it's a perfect system, we'll never get there.
You're never going
to
have
that. To
where
you say, okay, well, we have a perfect system that we don't incarcerate anybody that's innocent. Until we can get to that point, we need to set death row on the side and say, look, until we get all these appeals done, until we do all the DNA, until we have innocence projects that are working around the clock and that, the cycle of innocent people going in, that they're getting out before 20 and 30 years, the death penalty needs to be laid down.
Well, it speaks to the ego or the arrogance of this nation that, and it goes to the argument that does life matter?
That's right.
If it's one life in 20 years, that's bad enough. But I think we've lost the sense of the value of human life. So if you can say, well, it's 2.3 million people or billion people in the United States. So if we kill 10 of them, it really doesn't matter. It doesn't really make a big difference. But that's when we've lost the sense of what America is supposed to be. Every life has value. I don't care if you're black, white, red, or yellow. Your life has value. And like you said, you're never going to have a perfect system as long as you have human beings running this system.
That's right.
Because they're subject to human error. But now, the sad part, it goes beyond human error now. It goes to deliberate actions by prosecutors and judges to convict people. So when you have a lack of morality within a system and a lack of good judgment and corruption, you have to take the death penalty off the table because now the judge may wake up one morning and say, I don't like you. We're going to go ahead and kill him.
That's right. And if you look at the entire world, you look at every other country that has a so-called democratic judicial system, they said, hey, the death penalty is off the table. It just doesn't work. It's bad enough to lock a person. I mean, here in some countries, they say, hey, the maximum amount of time for any crime that you spend is 20 years. You've learned your lesson. There is no death penalty, and your record is expunged after that. And it's showing that with shorter sentences, with rehabilitation, and with programs in place that helps a person to reestablish themselves into society once they paid their debt, it's shown that that recidivism, however you say it, people going back to prison, and the fact of crime is down. When you implement these things only in America, and of course we understand that we have the industrial prison complex, that people are put in prison here as commodities, as slave labor. So, but with that, at least take the death penalty off the table. I mean, because the entire system, you know, I say it all the time, this baby needs to be thrown out with the bathwater, because this baby has died and is corrupted and stinks. So it all needs to be flushed down and rebuilt. Make another baby. That's not difficult.
Well, yeah, and I think if enough people, we say it all the time on this program, that we need people to speak up, to take a stand, and to make things happen. It's going to require some work of everybody, you know, to get involved, to say, you know what, we're not, communities to come together and say, we're not going to take the garbage. But I believe that is why the police epidemic at least is being attacked. It's on the forefront of the news. People are talking about it. People are starting to question the behavior. You know why? Because somebody is speaking up, and I believe Americans are speaking against it now. You cannot take a stand and march on streets and do what you're doing without it having an impact. Look at the impact that has happened from Ferguson alone, and the worldwide coverage of that.
And you know, Cliff, you were just talking about whether or not the use of the death penalty is really making an impact, and there have been studies upon studies on whether or not the use of the death penalty deters crime.
Right.
And like you said, they found that it does not. And specifically, one study that was done in North Carolina showed that over the past several years, there have been a steep drop-off in the use of the death penalty, but it didn't have any – The use of the death penalty, I should say, did not have an impact on crime itself. So, you know, they have not been able to draw a correlation between, okay, we just keep executing people and that's going to make the crime rate go down. That's not what it's about. I mean, the crime rate has gone down even though the execution rate has gone down.
Exactly. And the thing is, when a person, when a criminal is about to commit a crime, they don't say, you know what, if I'm going to die for killing this person, then I'm going to rethink it. That holds no bearing on a person that decides they're going to take another life. That's not a deterrent to say, okay, well, if this country has the death penalty, then I'm not going to kill this person. You're either going to do that or not. So for America to say, well, we need to keep the death penalty, for what reason? Who can explain why the death penalty is still in place? It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
And, you know, there is information out there on the various states that where governors have signed off on legislation to make the death penalty illegal. And as of last year, you can go to deathpenalty.procon.org. Again, deathpenalty.procon.org, and that's the pros and cons of the death penalty, and they list several states that over years and even in recent years. In 2012, Connecticut made it illegal. And one thing there, though, they did not make it retroactive, so folks who were already on death row could still potentially be executed. In 2011, it shows that Illinois made it illegal. In 2013, Maryland. And the list just goes on and on and on. But there are several states who have made it illegal. And so, you know, I think to your point, Lamont, the fact that and you know, we've had this conversation where so many things over the last year that have occurred across the nation have drawn scrutiny and drawn the attention of lawmakers because of the protests and people hitting the streets and people, you know, raising awareness of the wrongful acts that have been occurring in their communities. Now it's getting the attention of the national legislators. And actually, you know, we had one lawmaker even tell us that it's always been there. But now, because it is so much of it,
right,
you know, people are finding it convenient. I don't know. You don't want to think of it as a political pawn issue, so to speak, that, well, I have to talk about this because it is such a hot button that if I don't talk about it, then people are going to think that I don't care. But you want to believe that people are really taking a look at it because there's no other way to say it. Wrongful convictions, wrongful deaths. People being, unarmed people being shot down in the streets, wrong is wrong. And people just need to, you know, take a look at that and hold folks accountable and see, you know, that we cannot allow on either side of the equation. You can't allow citizens of this nation to just run rampant and run rogue all over the streets and just, you know, have no consideration for the law and just do whatever they want to do. But then at the same time, you can't have law enforcement professionals doing whatever they want to do just because they carry a badge and because they, have a weapon.
And both issues are equally as damaging, both issues. So there has to be a balance here.
Absolutely.
You know, people say, well, we don't want criminals running the streets loose doing what they want. Well, it's just as bad for a cop to be. Matter of fact, it's worse.
Oh, it's
if
much
a cop,
worse.
If a cop is running rogue. Well, guess what? He's got a badge he can hide behind and a weapon he's allowed to carry and can kill you with justification by the society in which we live these days. You know, they can get away with that.
That's right.
And that's the difference. So I think the point is, I think that's a good point, that you have police officers running rogue. And again, we're not saying all cops are that way, but for the ones that are, they have to be stopped.
Yeah, because if the government, if the so-called justice system or law enforcement has rights that the citizen doesn't have, then that becomes absolutism and that becomes tyranny, because then you're looked at as a lower class citizen than those who have the authority over you. That is the definition of tyranny. That is why, you know, the forefathers said, hey, we have the right to bear arms, because you never want to allow your military or your law enforcement to have more powerful arms than your people, because then they can basically enslave them.
Absolutely.
I mean, you look at the countries that say, okay, citizens aren't allowed to have weapons, but law enforcement, their armies, their military can. That's tyranny. So in America, the forefathers set about to ensure that there would be no tyranny, that, you know, it's basically a country with laws laid out by the people and for the people.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're seeing that the system is circumventing the Constitution, that to give a prosecutor immunity, to give a judge immunity, to give them full authority to do what they want to do, to be able to shoot a man down in the street and then say, you know, we can't even get a grand jury indictment for whatever reason, but the most likely reason is because this is a black man that got shot, and a so-called black criminal or somebody who had a troubled past, or he could be a thug or whatever, to let a white officer shoot him and there's no repercussions, then the person that you allow the officer to shoot begins to climb a little bit higher up the chain, but as long as he's a black man, then you get to, as long as it's the president and he's black and somebody shoots him, there's no need to bring an indictment.
Well, the bizarre part about Ferguson to me, out of the whole situation, if Attorney General Eric Holder finds these type of numbers of disparities of targeting black young men or African Americans in that community, how then can you come back and say that Officer Wilson is not liable for the death of this man?
That's right. This is a systematic problem in the Ferguson Police Department with basically racial discrimination. For an officer to tase a man who's having a seizure and bites a EMT tech unknowingly, you tase me while I'm having a seizure.
I'm sorry, he's biting the tech to try to fill his tongue.
Right. But I don't even know I'm biting him. I'm having a seizure. I'm nowhere on this planet.
Wow.
I'm unconscious. The only thing that's happening is every nerve synapse in my body is firing at the same time. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not really biting. My jaw is clamped.
Absolutely.
For you to tase a man who's having a seizure, and because he was an African American, how do you not say the whole police force needs to be brought up on charges? And then now prove yourself innocent that you wasn't a part of this systematic problem.
Absolutely.
Or weren't a part. I don't know your proper grammar.
Right.
Well, you know, there's a lot of information out there on this. And when you talk about the disparities, the disproportionate sentencing, it's enough information that we talk about alone on this program that points to the fact that there are problems that that need to be fixed. As we talk about the IRP6 again, we ask that you go out to freetheirp6.org. And here are six men whose families are impacted significantly by their wrongful conviction and the fact that they have now been incarcerated wrongfully for going on 3 years. And Lisa, what are we asking our listeners to do?
We are asking everyone who is able to go out to GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. And do a search on IRP6. You'll find a link there where you can donate directly to the IRP6 families and help them through this difficult time while their household wage earners are wrongfully incarcerated at this time. They need your help.
And also, you know, we ask that you, again, go out to freetheirp6.org, and you can find a lot of information out there. If there's some way that, you know, if there's someone that you know that you can reach out to and say, hey, I need you to take a look at this case, we ask that you do that. I mean, A Just Cause will continue in the fight to get the IRP6 exonerated, and we're talking to people every day about this, but we are not short on asking for assistance from folks who are in our listening audience as well. For AJC programming, you can also go to AJCRadio.com for archives of our weekly broadcast. You can also catch 24/7 AJC programming at Live365.com. And on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, you can go to the Progressive Radio Network, and that is at prn.fm. And for on-demand programming, you can go to the 405radio.com, or you can download at iTunes. Again, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Cliff.
All righty, I want to say thank you to everyone in the chat room. Those questions and comments that you offer are extremely valuable to us. Thank you to our guest, Victoria Redstall, and also Burl Bear, for calling in and spending time out of your evening with us tonight. We definitely appreciate it. We also want to say thank you to our production team, K&D Productions, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson helping out Ill Skillers Girl in the control room, and to our production support team. They give us accurate and up-to-date information so that we can pass that on to you. And to the truth, we know you're out there. We appreciate it.
Also want to say thank you to Olivia and Ms. Barbara, who's out there doing work behind the scenes for us, making our jobs a little easier. We appreciate it.
And we'd ask that you join us each Tuesday and Thursday evening right here on A Just Cause Coast to Coast from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, where we will bring you more information and education and awareness about judicial injustice. Do you guys know what this weekend is?
Spring forward,
isn't it?
Yep. And so, you know, we'll get to enjoy a little bit more daylight on that one. I think that's right, isn't it?
And a little less sleep.
You lose an hour of sleep.
Also this weekend marks the 50th anniversary of the March in Selma. And so, you know, that's something that's critical to our history.
Sure.
And because of the fact that, you know, when you really look at that situation and the question is being asked all over the place, you know, what's the difference in 50 years ago and now with regard to some of the judicial processes and judicial injustice? Unfortunately, the answer to that is not much difference. I mean, some of the same corruption as identified in the DOJ report out of Ferguson. You look at that kind of thing, that's straight out of 50 years ago. But we're looking at now 2014, 2015, and the Department of Justice is still reporting on that type of corruption, there's something wrong. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. On behalf of Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks, I'm Sam Thurman. Good night, America.
Good night.